a much smoother ride for commuters on I-95 North this morning. Your traffic questions answered just ahead. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on that massive Overland Bridge project. Did it slow you up this week? We've also got an update on tolls potentially coming back to town as we speak with FDOT and another expert on traffic projects. Get on the line now. Call us up, 549-2937, to join the show. Also this morning, the faces of HIV in Florida told in a new traveling exhibit going all around the state. Then later, Jazz Night in America host Christian McBride. He'll perform in town this weekend. We'll tell you where you can get your tickets. All of that ahead. But first this hour, smooth sailing this morning for a change on I-95. A big relief for commuters after a couple of days of big delays and headaches. That's because of the massive Overland Bridge project. Now, on Monday and Tuesday, traffic lanes were moved on I-95 near downtown, causing massive backups during the morning commute. So what's the latest on this project, and what plans are in the works for other big transit projects around town? We have two experts with us, Kim Holland of RSNH. She's the lead designer on the Overland Bridge project. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Carrie Stanbridge, construction engineer with FDOT. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And we want to speak to all the commuters out there. Did you have trouble getting to work earlier this week? How was your commute this morning? What are your questions about the I-95 Overland Bridge project? And what are your questions about potential toll lanes coming back to this area? That could be in the works. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on Facebook. Let's begin with you, Carrie, representing the Florida Department of Transportation. Monday was tough. Tuesday was tough. But this morning, I actually came in via I-95 northbound, and it was pretty smooth. So that's good news. Let's begin with that.
Fantastic. We're glad to hear that. We're getting a lot of compliments on the roadway and the ride, and we're real excited to hear that.
Let's explain what this project is all about, because it's been in the works for some time. This is a massive undertaking for FDOT.
It is a massive undertaking. This $161 million project is going to take us 3 to 4 years to complete. We're looking hopefully to bring everything online end of the year 2016, beginning of 2017. We're looking at adding capacity, improving safety, and hopefully making the operation of the interchange and those affected in the area a little bit better for everyone.
Kim Holland of RSNH, lead designer on the project. The purpose of improving this interchange is basically to improve traffic flow, to really account for what you expect to be a lot more cars on the roads in the coming years, where I-95 and I-10 meet. Isn't that right?
That's right. There were several different reasons for doing this project. One was to improve capacity, make enhancements to safety, provide all movements at the Atlantic interchange, and accommodate all of the volumes of traffic and replace the Overland Bridge. From a design perspective, I will tell you that we looked at this, how do we innovate? How do we make this project better and provide better value for the public? And I'd love to talk more about some of the improvements that were made. It's a fabulous job, and it's going to be great when it's finished.
People are driving over them. They don't really know what they are. So what has gone into it?
One great improvement that we made when we started working on this project, we looked at how could we improve the Atlantic Interchange itself. We actually ended up restacking the design and consolidating the interchange based on what the original design looked like. And some of the advantages that it's giving the public, it's improving our maintenance of traffic operation. So a lot of components can be built out of the way while traffic's running concurrently. We were also able to avoid a major utility relocation that saved the public $800,000 It took 500 days out of the schedule. So that means it minimizes disruptions to travelers. Also, we were able to reduce some high elevations, and the adjacent neighborhood was extremely happy to see those profiles come down.
Absolutely. And we want your calls as we discuss the massive Overland Bridge project right there at I-95 northbound, south of downtown. Commuters, give us a call with your stories, with your thoughts and questions. We'll go to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. And so when is all this going to be wrapped up? Carrie Stanbridge, it looks as though you're getting a lot closer to the end than you were just a few days ago.
Absolutely. We're targeting the end of the year, and the design build team is on track to make that happen. Hopefully, we don't run into the holidays, but, you know, things happen, weather and holidays, and we may end up at the beginning of 2017. But with this traffic shift, this opens up tremendous opportunity for other areas to work in. So that's a great thing for the design build team and their resources.
All right. And let's shift gears now and talk about another hot topic. Something tells me the phones are about to light up when I bring up this. It's actually, some might say it's a four-letter word in Jacksonville, tolls. Actually, toll is a four-letter word. Let's talk about the long-term plans to bring back pay lanes, or what they call express managed toll lanes, for I-295. And give us a call with your questions about this, listeners, at 549-2937. Oh, look at that. I see them lighting up. How about that? Isn't that amazing? Carrie Stanbridge, can you bring us up to date on what FDOT's thinking is, and what are we looking at when it comes to managed express toll lanes for this region?
My understanding with tolls is as we add capacity, we will be looking to toll those facilities. We must find a way to pay for, to fund, to maintain our facilities, and this is a way to do that.
And where would they be placed?
In terms of?
When I say I-295, would that be the entire Beltway?
No, my understanding at this time is it's the Outer Beltway 23 and our added new capacity lanes on 295. So where we add new capacity lanes, so travelers will have a choice. It's not mandated that you would have to do that. It would be in the new added managed toll lanes.
So many other cities have this option, and when people travel, they might notice this. So this would bring the First Coast into line with what a lot of other cities have already gone to.
Correct. And the Florida Department of Transportation is very aggressive with the SunPass program and basically the entire toll program. It will be all electronic, and it will be such that you can go from city to city, state to state. That's the overall goal, is that it is, you know, essentially one system that tracks on each other, so to speak. You don't have to get a different pass for a different road, for a different county, for a different city.
Kim Holland, designing these types of projects, as you mentioned, whether it's capacity lanes or a bridge that goes over land, it's complicated and it's expensive. Someone's got to pay for it.
It is, and I think you bring up some excellent points. The firm that I work for, RSNH, we are the FDT's general consultant for the First Coast Expressway, and that is going to be a fully tolled facility. It was part of that mandate that as we add capacity, it will be tolled. The first section that comes online, which is down in the Blanding Boulevard, and then north of that, the tolls are not going to be expensive. They're actually going to be close to about 15 cents per mile. And then we are looking at expanding that roadway south of Blanding. So that's the next piece that's coming. Also, as you mentioned, 295 down in the Mandarin area, it will have several general purpose lanes, which means those are free, and you will have access to better reliability and timing in your travel by paying for tolls. So there will be two toll lanes.
And what's the timetable for those to be installed?
The First Coast Outer Beltway, we are looking at the end of next year for a portion of that to come online. And then as far as the tolling, we are still working with our partners at the Turnpike, because that's who we coordinate with, as to when that equipment will actually go into play, so to speak. So that's inexact at this point.
Let's go to your calls right now as we speak with FDOT, Carrie Stanbridge, construction engineer, and Kim Holland, of RSNH, lead designer on that Overland Bridge project. What are your questions about that project? What are your questions about toll lanes coming back to this area? 549-2937 to join the show. Chris in Jacksonville. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Melissa. How are you doing?
All right. Thanks.
Good. I travel to Jacksonville. I travel for a little, actually in Stuart, Florida, on my way down to Pompano Beach. But about twice a month, I travel in Miami, and I exclusively use the express lane on I-95. And I'm just telling you, it makes, for the most part, things so much easier and so much smoother. And I'm absolutely offered the choice to use express lanes. And I do have a question, though. I want to make sure that when they do go in place, that they will actually be incorporated into the SunPass system. Will they?
Yes, they will.
Yes, they will. Okay. So if you have a SunPass already, you can seamlessly just start using them, Chris.
Wonderful. Good. I'm glad to hear that that will actually be, those will be built in and used. Great idea. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Chris. And Carrie, for people in this area that have never used SunPass, that's something that might be new for a lot of folks in Jacksonville.
Absolutely, and we will be bringing that to you live. We will have links and tutorials and some sessions, public open houses, so to speak, so folks can get online quickly and learn.
And basically what it is when I used to live in Orlando, I was familiar with it. It's a transponder that you mount on your windshield so that you can just go right through the toll booth.
Correct.
Without having
Absolutely.
To drop pay an attendant or drop in a coin.
Absolutely. And we have the ability to buy a transponder and transport it from car to car, or you can buy a sticker and put it directly on your car.
And Melissa, to your point, it is going to be all electronic tolling, so there won't be
no coins.
No coins.
No manned attendants.
Correct.
Okay. I need to get into the 21st century with this, don't I? I still have this vision of people dropping in coins. That is not happening here in this area.
Right.
549-2937, Bruce in St. Augustine. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning. I just wanted to congratulate Tim and the entire RSNH team for this Overland project. This was a very complicated project, and I just wanted to say, as a engineer in the community, I'm very proud to see the great job that's been done. And my question is, I understand there is another section from the Overland Bridge to the J. Turner Butler Boulevard, and where do we stand on the design on that? Thank you.
That's an excellent question. The section that's going to run south from Overland, we don't have plans to take that to construction just yet. It's actually in a phase that's called a PD&E, which is a study, and we're looking at that project from a design standpoint and how we can expand what we're already doing on Overland. The next piece that you actually will see is north of the Overland Bridge, and that's some of the improvements that we'll see at the Fuller Warren. So that's actually the next piece that's coming from a construction standpoint in that area.
We have calls from all over the area. Kenneth is in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
All right, thanks. How are you?
Oh, fine. I can't speak to the Overland Bridge part. I probably used it and never realized I have. I live down in Palm Coast. But I would like to speak to the project or the thought of having a specialty lane, if you want to call it that, where it's like the Beltway on the 295. For certain vehicles, whether it be tow or high occupancy vehicles. I drive over the road, been doing it for like 27 years now, and I just see that they never work. It's the craziest thing in the morning and the afternoon when you're sitting in, you know, gridlock traffic and you see 5 or 10 cars pass you by, and then in those lanes, and then, you know, 2 more, 20, 30, 40 seconds go by, 5, 10 more cars pass you by. And when those lanes could be used to move all that traffic. I mean, people just are not going to do the high occupancy thing. They're going to get in their own cars today. It has never changed anything from my scene. And I've been in major cities from L.A. to D.C. I go up to D.C. quite often, New York quite often. And it's just the craziest thing you see in the morning and the afternoon. Those lanes are just, the traffic is, the difference in the traffic is just ridiculous. I mean, those lanes could be used to move all these people down the road equally. You know, you shouldn't have to pay a toll, I feel, or have a high occupancy to have all these lanes to be utilized. It's very limited real estate. I-295 is very connected to Jacksonville itself. It's not like a major city like Houston where it has three beltways around it. You only have this one, and it's very connected to a lot of intricate parts of Jacksonville for business purposes, commercial-wise, trucking, and just people getting to work. You got the major health industry downtown on the JTB. It's just way too utilized to take and start separating lanes off just for toll people want to pay a toll. It's like a privilege lane. Let's call it a privilege lane.
Okay. Thanks, Kenneth. What about that? The HOV, are we even doing HOV lanes?
No. It's basically called managed lanes, and people do have the option whether they want to pay or they want to drive for free. But overall, the people that do pay, it still takes traffic out of those general purpose lanes, and it provides extra capacity even in the free lanes. You're going to have better reliability and better travel time in the tolled lanes, but you should see improved travel times in the general purpose as well.
But these will not be what are known as HOV lanes, where like a carpool car can use a lot of people inside one car, which is what he's referring to.
No, and to his point, a lot of the lanes in the South Florida area that were HOV, those have actually been converted to these managed lanes where you're paying the tolls to utilize
them. What some people might call Lexus lanes. I've heard that term, although that's not what we're going to officially use here today. But let's go now to Al in Jacksonville. Hi, Al.
Hi, Melissa. I've got a negative comment about SunPass systems. I don't drive in South Florida, and I don't use the SunPass or the toll roads, and I've been cited about six times now by SunPass as violating the toll booth or whatever it is. Each time it's a $3 penalty, and I have to get on the phone and spend time trying to get out from having to pay that $3, which has become a real irritant. And I just wonder if anybody is trying to improve the cameras or a better system for checking the DMV and what kind of vehicle so that they can not do this kind of thing. It's pretty bad.
All right. Thank you for that.
Al, Carrie? That's a great comment. We constantly at the Department of Transportation look to improve our processes and performance. And the folks at the Turnpike who evaluate essentially all of these tolls, charges, and such constantly are looking at performance and seeking feedback like yours. And we'll get that in the pot and see where we're at. There is an improvement. They do keep measures relative to these things. And so, yes, there's a constant improvement. If there's a specific issue, let us know, and we'll take a look at that. So we'll get your comment into the pot.
Sandra, we lost Sandra. Melissa in Orange Park. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to confirm two things with the engineers. The first is that there will be lanes where you don't have to pay everywhere in the system. I will be taking that 295 road every single day, so it's not, it's not a huge amount per mile, but it will add up to my daily commute. It will add to my cost. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was, I wanted to find out if there would be sufficient areas built into the traffic pattern that when there are accidents, they can be pulled out of all the lanes and not just out of the pay-as-you-go lane and into the lanes that are free. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Okay. How about that?
That's an excellent question. And to her point, first asking if there's a breakdown of the vehicle, whether you are in the lanes that require tolling or the general purpose, there's enough space if you have a disabled vehicle where you'll be able to pull over. That's actually a standard design requirement that we do provide that. And again, to her point, she will have the option to travel on the free portions in the general purpose lane unless she's over on the First Coast Expressway. That entire corridor is tolled. But like I mentioned before, it's a nominal fee.
Okay. Aaron on the north side. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there, how are you?
All right, thanks.
Quick question. I just want to make sure I understood one of your guest comments just a few minutes ago. These managed lanes, did she say that anybody can use those lanes whether they pay or not?
No. If you get into one of those lanes, you will have to pay. And you will have the choice. You can stay on, you will be able to stay on the free lanes, or you can choose to go a little quicker in one of the new managed lanes.
Correct.
Okay, but in the managed lane, you do have to have the pass or whatever in order to drive in that lane.
That's right. That's right.
And how is that going to be enforced, that general traffic isn't in that lane, slowing that lane down?
Okay, let's answer that one.
Big Brother is watching, basically. You all have cameras that take a picture, and you receive something in the mail saying you're being charged. As Al indicated, he's experienced that, so...
Lots of emails and tweets. Let's get to just a few of them. Regarding the managed lanes, Lowell emails the show, price goes up on demand. It's the Uber life. If you've got money, you've got a better life. What about more mass transit lanes instead of more cars? Robert has a similar email. What we need is more infrastructure for mass transit, not toll roads for private vehicles. And a tweet from Jay says the same thing. Wider roads aren't a long-term fix. They encourage more cars. What about high-speed rail and light rail? Lots of feedback coming in about mass transit as opposed to putting more cars on the roads. What do you both think about that?
From a transit standpoint, the DOT doesn't monitor our bus system. That's actually managed by the JTA.
Right.
JTA has made some incredible strides recently in their long-range bus systems. They just last month had a new BRT system. It's called the First Coast Flyer that came on board. And that does have the attention of our community, which it provides those longer-run buses for longer travels. From a light rail standpoint and even heavy rail, that's something that's always in our vision. But right now, the subsidy and the cost of that just isn't justified with the ridership that we have.
Your final thoughts, Carrie Stanbridge.
Just from the bigger scope of the Florida Department of Transportation, our leadership recognizes transit, freight, other things like that need to be looked at and considered. The answer is not to build out everything. We've got to look at other opportunities and other options.
Well, we thank you both so much for joining us. Two women leading on this massive project, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Carrie Stanbridge is a construction engineer with the Florida Department of Transportation. Kim Holland of Reynolds Smith & Hills RS&H, the lead designer on the I-95 Overland Bridge project. And much more still ahead later in the hour.
My number one goal as a musician, once I fell in love with the music, was to be respected by all of the great musicians who I admired. You know, I figured if I could get the respect of those people, that to me is success.
Jazz Night in America host Christian McBride gives us a preview of his live show this weekend at the Ritz Theater. But up next, real-life stories of hope as the Faces of HIV Project comes to the First Coast. That's in a moment.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater. What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Sponsored in part by Folio Media House.
Even in tough economic times, there are many local stories of success. I'm Karen Mathis with the Daily Record. On First Coast Success, I speak with Northeast Florida business executives and entrepreneurs about their experiences and accomplishments. Hear the interviews the last Monday of each month on First Coast Connect or on demand at wjctnews.org.
brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
The coming El Nino could bring Southern California the water it needs if we can hang on to it.
When it rains now, that water is largely lost to the LA River. What we're designing these projects to do and what the hope is that that water will be collected here and then returned to the groundwater system.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Anglican churches sprang up around the world under the British Empire. Now Anglicans in Africa oppose liberal church views on homosexuality.
The imposition of new approaches to what it is to be human is resented more deeply than it is possible to describe.
The Archbishop of Canterbury facing a worldwide split among Anglican churches later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new mobile art project allowing people from all across the state to experience real-life stories of inspiration and also the battles and challenges of living with HIV. Through captivating portraits, insightful interviews, and poignant journal writing, the Faces of HIV project examines the effect of stigma, the personal relationships, and the care issues associated with being HIV positive. The project launched with a mobile art exhibit in Tallahassee, with continuing stops in cities across the state. Faces of HIV comes to Orange Park this Sunday at the St. James AME Church. Then it moves on to Baker County for a Martin Luther King Jr. celebration Monday at Heritage Park Village in McClenny. We have more now as we welcome project participant Renee Burgess. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good to see you. And also with us, Terencia Shiloh. She's a Minority AIDS Coordinator with the Florida Department of Health, Area 4. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. And of course, the Florida Department of Health is spearheading this huge endeavor. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. But first, Renee Burgess, you're traveling with this project as it goes across the state. Your story is being shared with Faces of HIV. Can you share your story with our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. In 2007 is when I became diagnosed with HIV. I met my ex-husband 2002. We started dating 2005, and 2006, we decided that we wanted to be married. So the whole year of 2007, before our actual wedding date, we lived together, we were together. We even went beforehand to his primary care doctor for testing, because I did tell him I wanted to have testing and everything done prior to getting married, even though it wasn't required here in the state of Florida, mm-hmm. because at the time we were staying in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so we did that and sat in front of the doctor, and there was no papers exchanged. Because I'm sitting in front of the doctor, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, we are doing what is right, and he's going to tell me the truth because I'm telling him the truth. So I'm under the impression at that point that we are both negative, because we both told each other our test came back negative. So we proceeded to get married, and on November 21st, 2007, which was a couple weeks after learning that I became pregnant, I went into the doctor because I was dehydrated, and at that point they had my labs back. And when the doctor came in, she asked him to step out of the room. And when she asked him to step out, she came back in and she just had this look on her face like, I have to tell you, you know, like you have to tell me something, but you don't know how. And so when she just started talking, she's like, well, your labs came back and everything was fine with your labs except one thing. And I'm like, well, what is this one thing? You know, is it my diabetes? Because with my 12-year-old, who's 12 now, I had gestational diabetes, and it kind of lingered on through the years. So I'm thinking that's what it is. And she's like, well, no, your test came back saying that you're HIV positive. And she's like, well, do you want us to bring your husband back in the room? And I said, yes, because if you're telling me I'm HIV positive, he's the reason why.
Wow.
And so she brought him back into the room, and he just, you know, she said, well, do you want me to tell him? I said, yes, you tell him. And when she told him, the look on his face was not a look of someone who would be shocked or, you know, just not knowing. It was a look on his face is like, wow, she found out.
Oh, my gosh.
And so from that point on, I had to really decide, what am I going to do with my future? Do I stay with this man? Because, you know, I was educated on HIV and AIDS, being a medical assistant already. So it was like one of those things where this is a new marriage. We had just got married August, and here it is only a couple months later, I'm finding this out.
Oh.
And so I decided the whole month of December of that year that I wanted to come back here to Jacksonville, and that's what I did.
Did you leave him?
I left. At that point, I left. I didn't bring my stuff with me because I'm still, you know, it's still an initial shock to me. So I, in turn, stayed here in Jacksonville the whole month of December, and right probably 2 days after Christmas, I went back. And when I went back to South Carolina, I went back with the intention of only getting my stuff and leaving him permanently. So I waited, literally I waited till he left, because I knew that if I tried to leave while he was there, there was going to be some kind of disagreement. Oh no, I don't want you to go. So I waited till he went back to work from the holiday break, called a relative that I had just met when I moved to South Carolina, had never met before, and called him and called the close friend and said, hey, this is what happened. Those were the first two people other than my mom, that I had disclosed my status to. And they came and they helped me move. And I left and came back here. Mm-hmm. Now, once I came back here, probably mid-January, I got a call from my aunt saying, turn on the news. And when I turned on the news, there was an incident on there where it was a homosexual couple. The older male knowingly had infected the younger male and had been charged and sentenced to the maximum in the state is 5 years for the felony crime of knowingly infecting others with HIV. So when I saw that, I immediately called the sheriff's office and I said, this is what I just saw in the news and this just happened to me. What do I do? And I, in turn, they told me, well, you have to file a police report. And I know I didn't want to just file a report with anyone. So I called a police officer that I personally knew, and he came up to my home, took the report, got it to the detective at the sex crimes unit, and they proceeded to gather all the information they needed. And on Valentine's Day, I got a call from the detective asking me, you know, is there any way that I know that I could get a solid statement or something from him, definitely knowing, you know, from him, knowing that he did have this disease and that he knew he had it. And so what they said was, well, these are the questions we are trying to get. So for me, and knowing how he is, I say, well, I'll have to figure a way to get these answers, because the questions they're asking me were literally questions that I asked myself.
And long story short, was he charged?
He was charged. They were able to get the recorded confession from him where he knew he had it since the August 2002, a year before we ever met.
Was he convicted?
He was convicted with the maximum of 5 years. He spent 4 years in prison, got out a year early in 2012.
And how are you doing today?
I'm fine. My health has been fine. I've never had any complications or been hospitalized for having the virus.
Wow.
I have my children at the time. I was pregnant with twins. My twins are negative. So I've been living my life. I've been sharing my story and just, you know, just doing everything the way I know it should be done.
What an incredible story. Terencia Shiloh with the health department. I can see why you chose Renee to travel with this exhibit.
Absolutely.
It's a riveting tale, and it's a disturbing one, too.
Absolutely. And it gives people a more perspective on, you know, the virus and here locally. You know, people want to see, you know, here, you know, what, you know, people here locally that are actually living with HIV and AIDS. So it helps to give people that perspective that it is here and, you know, it's alive.
And it affects all kinds of people. And so Faces of HIV tells Renee's story and many other people's stories. How does it do that?
Well, it goes into the lives of, you know, it goes into inside their stories, actually, to give people a perspective on how they became infected, you know, how they first dealt with the diagnosis, how HIV affects the body, how it's affected their relationships moving forward with this type of diagnosis, and then how it affects their everyday life.
How has it affected your relationships, Renee, your ability maybe to get into a new relationship with somebody else and trust somebody else and all of that?
Well, for me, it was a challenge at first when I decided, hey, I want to start dating again, because I had to decide, how do I disclose? Because that's very important when it comes to having this virus, is disclosing your status. So it was, do I tell this person up front? Do I wait till I know if they want to have a relationship? And for me, doing it both ways, I found out that just being upfront and forward and just telling them, you know, this is what I have, you know, it's mm-hmm. here, it's not going anywhere. If you want to be with me or have a relationship, then, you know, I'm mm-hmm. here. If not, then, you know, we can be friends and move forward, you know. So definitely disclosing up front is always the best option.
And do you feel that this project is having the same kind of impact? Because it's being very upfront about these stories. What kind of impact is it having on people that come and see it?
Well, it's given, like I said, it's given them that up close and personal glimpse into the lives of people who are actually living with HIV and AIDS. So our goal is to reduce stigma that's associated with this particular virus, because social stigma, as we know it, it's hard. It's a large barrier here in our area, and even areas I can say across the country, when it comes to getting people tested for HIV or even getting people into care. So, you know, the exhibit is very impactful, we think. Again, the exhibit allows people from across the state to experience the real life stories of these courageous people, you know, and it's with our hopes to decrease new infections. You know, we want people to know.
Yeah, that is the biggest goal of all. Now, this exhibit is open to the public. And as I mentioned, there are a couple of opportunities to see it over the King holiday. Sunday, it's going to be at the St. James AME Church. That's at mm-hmm. Kingsley Boulevard in Orange Park. And then on Monday at Baker County's Martin Luther King Jr. Celebration at Heritage Park Village in McClenny from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Renee Burgess, you'll be there as well.
Yes. Yes. With the exhibit, what they try to do is wherever the exhibit is going in the state of Florida, if any of the participants are in that area, they usually either we volunteer or they ask if we are able to be there, because it gives the people coming to the exhibit a chance to see, hey,
the reality,
because a mm-hmm. lot of people think, oh, if you have HIV or AIDS, you're dying or you look sick. And then they see this person and they're like, wait a minute, is that you?
Yeah.
And it's, you mm-hmm. know, and it gives them that perspective mm-hmm. of, this is really somebody who has it, and they're not sick, and they're not dying.
Yeah, they're not dying. They're living with it.
Right.
And thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having
us.
She's Renee Burgess, participating with the Faces of HIV Project. We were also joined by Minority AIDS Coordinator Terencia Shiloh with the Florida Health Department. And in a moment, the latest from the Jacksonville Zoo, plus Jazz Night in America host Christian McBride.
Business is booming for America's temp agencies, but some workers are more equal than others.
They would ask for things like, we need country boys.
Or a person must have a corporate style, and those sorts of codes would be used to indicate send only white applicants.
To see this happening in America, it's insane. It's mind-boggling.
On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Greetings and a happy new year to all.
Join us Saturday for Swamp Radio's New Year's celebration, recorded live at the Florida Theater, featuring songs, stories, sketches, and conversations which celebrate Northeast Florida's arts and culture scene. Ooh. Swamp Radio, Saturday at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Yeah.
Welcome back. Well, most people visit the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens just to check out all the amazing animals, but they might not be aware of the conservation work that goes on there, along with some fascinating scientific research. Robert Mendick is supervisor of herpetology with the zoo. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And you're going to share some fascinating updates on, and I was not aware that this was happening, on the zoo's amphibian conservation programs. What's going on?
Okay, so amphibians, there's about 7,000 species in the world, 5,000 of which, give or take, are frogs. And these guys are
5,000 species of frogs.
5,000 species, that's right.
Wow.
Throughout the world, they're undergoing about a third of the species are threatened. They're going through declines due to a variety of factors, including habitat degradation. There's diseases that are affecting wild populations, pollution. So as part of our goal to conserve wildlife in wild places, we are involved in several conservation projects with amphibians.
And how do you go about that?
We support field research throughout the globe of various projects, biologists, researchers doing work in the field. We ourselves participate in several field-based projects, some here locally in Florida, others abroad. So one of our most successful programs is the conservation of the striped newt.
The striped newt. No relation to Newt Gingrich.
For some reason,
that popped into my head. Tell me more about the striped newt.
Okay, so the striped newt is a type of... newts are a group of salamanders. So they look like lizards, but they're not related to lizards. They're more closely related to frogs. They have slimy skin. And they were once widely distributed throughout Florida and Georgia. And over the last several decades, they've just been in decline. And in fact, here in Florida, there hasn't been one observed in the wild in over two decades.
Huh. So you want to not only conserve these species, which is so important, you're also launching at the zoo the local chapter of Frog Watch USA. What's that?
Right. So Frog Watch is what's known as a citizen science project. Citizen science gets the public involved in various scientific endeavors. Basically, there's not enough scientists out there to survey every living thing in the world. So by getting the public involved, it allows us to collect data that could be helpful in helping us understand how these animals are doing in the wild.
You're going to be launching this at the end of the month. And how can the public get more involved?
Okay, so we have a training session coming up on January 30th. It starts at 10 a.m. at the zoo. Where we go over identifying the various species of frogs, what to look for, what kind of data to collect. And so it's free. It's open to anyone that's interested in becoming a participant in this. We do ask to RSVP to volunteer at jacksonvillezoo.org.
Something tells me this is something that a lot of kids would be really interested in.
Right, and that's one of the...
You want to bring in kids.
Yeah, we want to bring in kids. We also want adults because we do need... responsible individual to collect the right
collect
type
the
of data,
data so but that parents it's useful. Can, but can certainly go out with their kids and,
absolutely.
And teach them that they're doing this.
And part of this project is getting these people involved where they can go to ponds and wetlands near their houses. And if they have a pond in their backyard, they can observe the amphibian, the frogs there, and report that information back to the scientists.
What a fascinating new program. It's the new chapter of Frog Watch USA launching on January 30th, a citizen science project at the Jacksonville Zoo. If you want to be part of it, as Robert said, just send them an email to volunteer@jacksonvillezoo.org. Be part of their conservation efforts. Robert Mendick is supervisor of herpetology at the zoo. You might not have known about this work going on there, but now you do, and we thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Well, finally this hour, he is the acclaimed host of the public radio program Jazz Night in America, heard right here on 89.9. Christian McBride performs this Saturday at the Downtown Ritz Theater. He gave us a preview of that show and a look inside what inspires his music. Christian McBride, welcome to the show and thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Lots of excitement that you'll be coming to Jacksonville and performing at the Ritz Theater. Of course, you're the host of our own Jazz Night in America program right here on 89.9. Can you give us a little preview about the show at the Ritz? People are really excited to come out and see you perform live.
Well, it's going to be a gas, as always, to come back to Jacksonville. I always have a lot of fun there, and many great musicians have come from there over the last number of years. There's a whole generation of bad dudes that come from Jacksonville. Ulysses Owens Jr., who played in my trio in big band for many years, and Jameson Ross and John Davis, and it's like, where are all these drummers coming from all of a sudden? They're all coming from Jacksonville. But
It's true. We have turned out some great musicians.
It's wonderful. But this trio that I'm bringing with me this time is actually not my usual working trio. However, it is going to be a trio full of my oldest and dearest friends. So it's going to be like a family reunion on tour. The great Peter Martin will be playing piano, and my dear old friend Carl Allen is playing drums. In fact, Carl played with me in Jacksonville maybe about a good 7 years ago. So it's going to be fun to play with Peter and Carl.
Excellent. Now, you're a four-time Grammy Award winner, and you've achieved so much at such a young age. What attracted you to this genre, and why do you think you've been able to become so successful so quickly in this field?
I don't know. You know, I guess success is always relative. You know, everyone has different definitions of what that is. But to me, success is being able to do what you love, you know, for a living. You know, I wake up every morning and I get to make music. You know, people want to pay money to hear me perform. I mean, that's the greatest blessing ever, you know. So music is what I love. Music is what my life is built around. And to me, that's success. You know, I never got into the music business because I wanted to be famous or because I wanted to be rich. You know what I mean? I think sometimes people get into a particular business for the wrong reasons. But my number one goal as a musician, once I fell in love with the music, was to be respected by all of the great musicians who I admired. You know, I figured if I could get the respect of those people, that to me is success.
Who do you admire most? Who were your biggest influences?
I have way too many people to start naming now, but, you know, my father and my great uncle are both bass players, and growing up around them and getting to hear all of this great music, all of these great records that they played, and hearing my father play with Mongo Santa Maria, and hearing my great uncle play with members of the Sun Ra Orchestra, there were so many musicians who I looked up to, particularly people like Art Blakey. I wanted to play with Art Blakey so badly. That was the number one gig that I wanted as a kid. But it wasn't just the older legends. I also admired and still admire Wynton Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard. And, you know, they're my big brother generation. So I wanted to play with them. Freddie Hubbard, whose band I actually did get to play in when I was first moved to New York. Betty Carter, the late, great Betty Carter, she was a huge influence on me in my early career. And I seem to have gained the respect of every musician who I looked up to and every musician I ever wanted to play with. So that to me is the ultimate goal, and I want to keep striving for that, to maintain their respect.
Let's talk a little bit about your public radio program, Jazz Night in America. It's been so well received. What's it like to work on that show?
It's fun. I love working with the team at WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, and Jazz Lincoln Center and NPR. It's a wonderful team of those three organizations. And this is now the second season of the show, and it seems to be, you know, it's being received well all over the country where people are hearing, and also online where people are watching the webisodes. So I really, really enjoy doing this and being able to report on what's going on in the jazz world.
Well, Christian McBride, it's a pleasure, and we thank you so much for giving us a few minutes. We look forward to seeing you here in Jacksonville.
Always a pleasure. I can't wait to play there.
That's Christian McBride this Saturday at the Ritz Theater. Get your tickets now at WJCT.org. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, political reporters weigh in on President Obama's final State of the Union speech. The president's final year agenda, including efforts to reform gun laws and address voter fears over terrorism and the economy. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day and enjoy the jazz.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.